Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. Lisa Anderson here with you, and it's always great to be with you, especially as we head into December. And a little preview of the show here coming up later for our inbox. We have a listener and a friend of the family who have been sort of betrothed since birth, and the problem is she actually likes this guy, and so her dad and this other dad are kind of conspiratorial about this, and she's like, okay, literally, like, I would like for this to happen, so what should this look like? But it's kind of awkward, so we're going to weigh in with some advice for her. And then for our culture, when Johnny Moore attended a graduation that would change his life forever, he learned that Christians all over the world are actually getting tortured and killed for their faith, even today. And so he's going to share some of the stories of these modern day martyrs and really challenges for us to live out our faith in a way that really glorifies Christ, whatever the circumstances. Well, here we are for our roundtable, and this is going to be our first ever conversation today on vaping. And maybe some of you are out there like, vaping, like, this doesn't, I don't even come across this. This doesn't even apply to me. But me living in Colorado, you know, a lot of people associate vaping with smoking cessation, with nicotine, with whatever. But here, like, I have a couple friends who have siblings who vape weed and other, you know, stuff like that. I mean, I guess it goes a lot of different ways. And I was just telling the panel here before we got started that I had this really weird thing of, I just saw someone vaping in a weird place, and I want to say it was church, and I just cannot remember, like, was it? Ah, that's so weird. But anyway, Kyle, Krista, and Dave are here to have this conversation with me. So welcome, y'all.
Hello.
Good to have you. Okay, so let's talk about, like, how, I mean, obviously, you know, it's not like all of us are like, yeah, you know, I personally vape and all this kind of stuff. But I feel like in the culture, in the media, as you walk down the street, whatever, it's just becoming more of a thing. And I was just reading something by Johns Hopkins, and they were talking about, like, okay, what are really the facts about vaping? And I think in their article, it was mostly related to vaping nicotine. And they said, yeah, you know, is it, if you're smoking cigarettes and you switch to vaping to stop, is that a good thing? Pretty much, yeah, because it's probably better than cigarettes based on their research. But is it good? No. And then they start talking about all the chemicals and all this craziness that, like, we haven't even gotten the full research or the scope of what's going on, which is shocking to me, because for people that don't want to eat anything that's not organic or non-GMO or everything that, like, today's millennials are all about, and, you know, being very responsible in so many ways, apparently this isn't one area where a lot of people have concerns. So what are your thoughts? What have you guys seen? What are you hearing on the issue?
It is crazy that a lot of people are going to vaping to break the cigarette habit. And it is safer to, you know, to puff away on a vape than to smoke a cigarette. But, you know, safer isn't safe.
Yeah.
And you're breathing in a lot of toxins, a lot of nanoparticles. There are lots of studies that show that you're increasing your risk of heart attack, stroke, coronary artery disease. And if you haven't smoked cigarettes, it really increases your likelihood that you're going to start smoking cigarettes. Yeah. So it's just not smart.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I think is so weird, is this whole idea of, like, you know, you forget, I mean, very few people that we're talking to here are probably like, you know, I've smoked my whole life and now I got to start vaping. It's like high school kids, college kids, young adults who are just starting vaping, having never smoked before, because they think, all I'm doing is puffing air vapor, you guys. So what are your thoughts?
I never vaped myself, but my adult son, he was really hooked on cigarettes and couldn't quit no matter what he tried. He heard about vaping and he thought, well, they're pitching it as this thing that's going to help me to quit. So, give it a shot. Well, what he found out is what a lot of people found out, that once you start vaping, a lot of times you'll continue the vaping, while you're continuing to smoke. So you've got a lot of people who are, they think they're going to get off of smoking. They're smoking and vaping now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I help lead with the youth. I usually work with high school kids. And that's just the big thing. They're always just like, yo, I got this vape. And I'm always seeing them like hang around. I was actually at a park once, and this is going to age me a little bit. But I looked at something on the ground, and I picked it up. And I was like, hey, who lost their USB? And one of my kids was like, oh, that's a vape cartridge. I was like, well, here I am, 26. But
sorry, just, you're 26 and ancient.
Yeah. But it's just, I don't know, like the kids just are into it, and it's just, they're so fascinated with it. And I've had to confiscate like two or three and just say, hey, what are you doing? You're not supposed to have this. You're not supposed to be in ownership of this. I've had kids trying to sell it. It's like, that's illegal. You don't need to be doing that. Mm-hmm. But it's just the cool thing nowadays. And just like you said, like in Colorado, you just walk around, you smell cotton candy, and you're like, oh, great. Like, mm-hmm. I want cotton candy now. And you just look, and it's like, it's Chad smoking up a vape pen. It's just like,
I want cotton candy. Okay.
Yeah. So it's just kind of an issue just with our younger generation, well, around the millennial age to the mm-hmm. high school generation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. It's a lot of the peer pressure. That's what it was for me, mm-hmm. Especially growing up, because I did vape. I only used it once, but I did. I used it, and it was that peer pressure and that thing to be cool because mm-hmm. everybody else was doing it.
Yeah. And just kind of, so how did that go, Krista? Like, someone's just like, hey, do you want to try this? Or were you like, had you heard anything about vaping prior to that?
I had not. Actually, I was like 15 or 16 and I was in my first job, and my manager, she had never smoked or anything like that, but she got herself a vape, and it started out with just like maybe a few puffs a day. And then it just got to where she was completely addicted. Mm-hmm. I never saw it out of her hands or out of her mouth. And it was just something that I continually smelled. And some of them do smell good. You know, like Kyle was saying, I want cotton candy. Some of them do smell good. Some of them don't. But it's just like she kept pressuring me to try it. And so I was like, well, they say it's better than cigarettes. Mm-hmm. So why not? And so I remember trying it, and my throat burned. It didn't taste as good as it smelled, and I was done.
Yeah. It looks super, like, complicated to me, and I'm guessing that it probably isn't, and once you get used to it, you just get used to it, and mm-hmm. it is what it is. But it just amazes me that I remember having a conversation with my nephew who tried it as well, and it was kind of like, he certainly had to be sneaky about it, like with his parents, because my sister would not have been down with that. I don't even think she understands what it is, quite frankly. But it's just one of those things, like at school, just hanging out after school or whatever. I mean, everyone's got their pens or whatever. Okay, Dave, you actually work with our Physicians Resource Council here at mm-hmm. Focus on the Family. So you know a lot of like the medical implications of this. But can you just explain a little bit, like, what for the person who is like, no, this is literally just flavored, vapored water. Like, that's not really what it is. What, give us the true picture of, like, why is it so addictive? What's going on in a vape?
Yeah, I mean, it would be great if you were just sucking in, you know, candy flavor all the time.
Yeah.
But
it would be very hydrating
if
you're just sucking in vapor, especially in Colorado.
But what you're really getting in almost all vapes is nicotine, a huge hit of nicotine. And you can have as much nicotine in one Juul pod as you'd get in a pack of cigarettes. So you're not only getting the nicotine, but you're getting a really, really great delivery. So you're getting a fast hit, you're getting a lot of it, and a lot of people are finding, you know, they'll try a Juul to break their cigarette habit, and a lot of them are finding, oh, you know what? The Juul habit, that's harder to kick now mm-hmm. because I'm really hooked on that nicotine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what about, and I know, like you said, you know, people vape nicotine at this point. People are vaping weed. Like I said, a couple of my friends, brothers, one of them in particular came and visited here in Colorado, and just him like vaping. It was weird because it's like in part, you're kind of like, okay, so I'm not really smelling it because I can't stand the smell of weed, which being in Colorado, you just walk into the supermarket and you smell it. So it was kind of, it's easier to kind of legitimize, you know, this because you're like, oh, it's not the horrible smell. It's not like polluting the air. Or it's not smelling up my home or whatever. But it almost makes it a little sneakier in that sense. Of
it does.
The way it
goes
down.
You're not standing on the corner with a joint hanging out of your mouth. So it's a little easier to get away with. Mm-hmm. Well, what they found as far as the health implications of this, you know, at present we've got 1,600 cases at least of lung injury associated with vaping and more than 30 deaths. And the vast majority of those are people who are vaping THC, the component of marijuana. It gets you high. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a, well, I'm not going to smoke it, so that's all cool. You know, you're getting other problems as well when you're doing THC.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, I mean, we can't turn to some book in the Bible and like look up in a concordance vaping and be like, what does God say about vaping? But there are obviously principles at play here. And so I would like to say, you know, it's like this weird fine line of, you know, because I know Christians who smoke. I know Christians who do a number of things that, you know, are whether they are proven detriments to your body. Hello, all Baptists and potlucks. Hello. Hello, me and the excessive number of cups of coffee I drink every morning, starting to taper, people, I promise. Anyway, we could talk about this related to anything, but let's just kind of get practical with it. So, you know, vaping, friends, family, what about dating? Would you, I mean, I know, you know, you got young adults, would you date someone who vapes or who says, you know, oh, I just do it either justifying it or they're doing it to quit smoking or they're, what do you guys think?
I mean, I don't think I would because it's like, you know, I mean, with my fiance, she said if I ever vape or do anything like that, she's leaving me. It's just like, so there's that. But also on top of that, it's just like, you know, it's not just the smoker that's affecting their own lungs. It's they're affecting the other person's lungs. So I don't want to be in an environment where I'm going to risk my health or later on down the line have my kids' health risked being in an environment of just smoke-filled lungs, and it gets pretty nasty. Mm-hmm. Just looking at pictures of, you know, smokers' lungs is pretty bad, but looking at contact smokers' lungs is pretty bad as well. So I don't think I would go for someone that smokes that much every day on a continuous basis.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I'd have to agree. I wouldn't. Yeah. It's just, like you said, you know, you're not only doing it to yourself, you're doing it to the other person. And in my mind, if there's that love and that connection, why would you want to hurt the other person in any way?
Mm-hmm. When you were talking, Krista, about your boss, like, would you say that she saw vaping as a problem or the amount of dependency she had on it? Or was it just like her thing?
Mm-mm. She justified it by saying that it was safer. There was no nicotine in it or anything like that. Like she said, it was just the flavored water vapor and that kind of stuff. So she justified it in tons of ways. And it was interesting to see the progression of her addiction to it.
I guess I just don't even understand what she thought was in it if she was clearly having
either.
An addictive response.
I don't either.
I guess this is very confusing to me. I feel like I'm going to have to like go and start asking people about this personally. I don't know. So backing up again, since clearly, you know, maybe at some point Krista's former boss will listen to this episode and get clued in on this. No, I'm just teasing kind of. But Dave, tell us, like, how does it actually work? What are we talking about here if people are not understanding what's actually going into vaping?
So basically the vaping instrument, the Juul or whatever, it just has a couple of simple parts. You've got a pod that contains the fluid, and you've got a heating element, and that heating element will vaporize whatever's in the liquid, and you suck it down or puff it in, and you get a big hit of whatever's in there. So, you know, if it's just cotton candy flavor, hey, cotton candy. THC, hey, you just got a nice lung full of THC. Mm-hmm. Or nicotine.
Yeah. Yeah, what it actually is. And
right.
And I was surprised by how in that article I referenced from Johns Hopkins, just about how they said just for the delivery method of it, the number of untested chemicals that are being used in vape pens and elsewhere, you know, as conduits of whatever, even though they say, oh, it's THC or it's nicotine. Well, there's a lot else that goes into it, too, to
well,
the product.
Well, and they say that, sure, it's safe, but nobody has long-term information on this. So if you're vaping, you are a guinea pig for Juul.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to find out in 20, 30 years
what
actually happens to a person who vapes. And they'll find out from you.
Yeah. I think what's so interesting about this conversation, which we could broaden to any vice, you know, and anything we're talking about, you know, that we can't say like, oh, is this sinful behavior or what is this? It comes down to what is our dependency in that sense? And, you know, some months ago for Boundless, I wrote an article on Christians and alcohol. And it's, you know, again, you can't turn to first and second alcohol in the Bible and be like, oh, what does this say? But it's interesting to me how many people will say, Christians have said to me, well, you know, I like myself better when I drink, or I feel like I can't go to a party unless I have a drink in my hand, or I just, you know, I'm doing it because it's social and it's fun. And like, you know, moms groups that get together and do like wine parties and all that kind of stuff. It's almost like we have to back up from what's right, what's wrong, trying to draw lines and be black and white and get back to the motivation of it. And again, it's really a, do we want to have this kind of dependency on something that ultimately can really rule us in that
right.
sense.
I mean, there's nothing in the Bible about vaping, of course, but Paul gives us some principles. He says in 1 Corinthians, all things are lawful to me, but not everything's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
All things are lawful, but I will not be dominated by anything.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul sets it out for himself. Hey, it may be lawful for me to do it, but if I'm going to be controlled by it, maybe addicted to it, that's not what we should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, same goes for us as Christians today. If something is addicting to us, if it's taking our focus off of God and making us dependent on that substance or behavior, it's probably not for us as a believer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you guys think? I mean, what would you say are just general ideas or principles around everyday life now? Friends, people at church, people, you know, you go to school with, whatever, who are vaping. I mean, you're going out to dinner with friends and a couple of them are vaping. I mean, for me, I would feel like I'd be looking around being like, oh, my goodness, does someone, you know, think I'm totally into vaping, or do they think I'm like on weed, or do they think like, I mean, it's just kind of a weird thing where you're like, you don't know whether or not, when that's just part of someone's normal experience.
And that's hard. That comes into just, you know, if it becomes a problem, like you're sitting at lunch and you're just puffing it, and they're just puffing it up, and then they're just like Thomas the Train and it's just going crazy, and you're like, you know, that's when you need to sit down and talk to them. Okay, this is kind of an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, I feel like a lot of high schoolers more so than millennials, but millennials as well are experiencing stress and depression, and that's how they're trying to alleviate it, and they're trying to, like, you know, use it as fitting in, but they're trying to use this way of like, you know, how can I deal with all of my stresses with school? How can I deal with all my depression with this situation? Let me smoke a little bit, and that'll take some of that pressure away, because I know some smokers, vaping or cigarette wise, they do that to relieve stress. And it just comes to the end of the day, you just need to sit down with that friend or that, like, you know, that person that you care about and say, hey, why are you doing this? This is how it comes across in the general public. Are you stressed? Because if it is, just, you know, take up kickboxing, take up, you know, something to healthier to just alleviate that, dependency upon vaping and smoking.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I would say is if you're thinking of vaping, you need to be thinking about the people around you. And are some of those people, maybe you don't know about it, but they're trying to quit vaping. And if you just pull it out and start puffing, are you going to be contributing to their failure to beat their addiction? I'd say don't go there.
Yeah.
Don't be that person.
Yeah. I think I just remembered where I saw people vaping, and it was at a craft fair So that is really weird because it was actually like these grandmas who were looking, like I was standing at this booth looking at stuff and they were standing next to me looking at the same stuff. And then two of them like pulled out their pens and were just like full on vaping. And I just have said, you know, it was just the weirdest thing for me because I'm like, you know what? Let's grab our pens. Let's go look at some crafts. It just seemed very disjointed
to me. Let's go, ladies.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe it was like a grandma's vaping club or whatever. But yeah, it was really weird. So, well, I think this is helpful just to get the conversation going and to think about, you know, some of the concerns around this. And like I said, I mean, here in Colorado, this is something that we've seen happening for a while. Maybe for others of you out there, it's newer and stuff. But I think it does help for us to be thoughtful about it and, you know, cautious. Again, as Dave said, we don't even know what, you know, what research is going to be coming in related to this and just straight up what's going into your body, but also who or what are you dependent on and what does that look like? It's great food for thought for all of us. So thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Well, here we are for our culture segment, and a little while ago, Katherine Anderson did an interview with Johnny Moore about modern-day martyrs and how we need their kind of faith. Let's hear what he had to say.
Well, Johnny, welcome to The Boundless Show. Thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here.
Good, good. We're so glad to have you. Your book is one of those books that I was thinking about as I drove home the day after I read it. I mean, it's one of those, it just sticks with you, this topic. It's so, you know, I think of like Philippians, I think it's 4, and they say, Paul says, think about whatever is noble, whatever's true. And I just think these stories are so in that wheelhouse. Yeah.
This is why I wrote them. I mean, I've been fortunate to travel all around the world myself and sit with persecuted Christians. And I kept finding myself saying, like, I wish you could meet so-and-so. I wish you could meet so-and-so. Or come with me to this place. And, you know, not everyone can do that. And so I just decided to go on this mission to record their stories. And even as I was preparing for this interview today, I pulled out the audio recording of one of the stories. And I listened to the voice of the lady talk again about her experience because you know, these are real people. These are real moms. They're real dads. They're real young people. You know, one of the people I write about in the book was 12 years old, you know, the first time he was wow, arrested. I mean, it's crazy.
And I think we tend to look at them like Bible characters. We're like, well, they were superheroes. It came easier to them. Faith came easier to them, but it didn't. And it's just, you know, we're on the same level as them in God's eyes. And it's just you know,
this,
crazy.
And this is Christianity, right? I mean, right. Christianity is not a religion of the superheroes. It's a right. religion of the everyday people that really rely on God. And there's not a person in the Martyr's Oath that's famous. They're just everyday people who, you know, have decided to live what they say they believe.
It's amazing. I want to start with, you had a moment at a graduation that kind of changed everything for you, what you saw that day. Tell me about what happened.
Well, look, I mean, I'm a typical millennial. You know, I'm 36 years old. I had illusions of grandeur, you know, and the world I was looking at. And I decided to get on an airplane at the advice of a friend and just go to India. And I was going to go to a Bible school graduation
service.
Sounds
very millennial.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's you know, what we do. You know, we just get on an airplane and figure it out later, right? And make sure you find the Starbucks. But what was amazing is I get to this Bible school graduation, and I was a college student myself and already working at Liberty University at the time, actually. And I bent a lot to graduation, so I was expecting a graduation, you know, get your diploma, like, you know, caps and gowns and off you go. But this one was different. The 2,000 students that were there were largely orphans who had grown up in these Christian orphanages. They decided to be missionaries and pastors to their own people. And as a graduation present, they were giving them a one-way train ticket, a new Bible, and a bicycle.
And before they got their diplomas, they had a different part of the ceremony. They all had to stand up, all 2,000 of them, and they had to recite a martyr's oath. They had to state that they were willing to lose everything, even their lives, in their ministry for Jesus. And it wasn't, by the way, that, you know, the leaders of the Bible school were trying to provoke them to die martyrs. It was just that the founder of the Bible school, a legendary Indian Christian who became a mentor of mine, M.A. Thomas, he didn't have a good conscience about giving these people a diploma if they didn't know what it might cost them, because it had almost cost him his life. He had had 15 assassination attempts
on his
life.
This guy mentored you too?
Yeah, well. Yeah. He was also like a millennial. I decided to go to the country again, and I spent, you know, I stayed at his house for weeks at a time, and I had three meals a day with him. He was like a modern day Apostle Paul. But I remember standing in the middle of that graduation service as M.A. led these people in the martyr's oath, and they responded that they were willing to die. And I felt like I finally understood my faith. I was like standing in the book of Acts. It's not something I had ever seen before. I had read about it. But, you know, I had kind of had a form of godliness with no power. And this really was a shockwave to my soul, good millennial soul.
What did their faces look like? Could you see them when they were reciting that oath?
Yeah, they knew what they were doing.
And the oath says, "I will die." I mean, what exactly?
Yeah, I mean, in the book, in the martyr's oath, it's it isn't the exact oath, because the exact oath, you know, this is sort of a funny story, had a lot of plagiarism in it. when they had written the oath, you know, they had taken Christian lyrics from songs. You know, they were, as Indian Christians are prone to do, you know. And so I wrote an oath inspired by their oath, anchored in scripture. But yes, it said that they were willing to die for Jesus. They were willing to lose anything for Jesus. They were willing to be beaten for Jesus. And by the way, many of them had been. There was a church on the complex, actually. And the church was too small now for the graduation service. They set up a big tent for the service. But if you went inside the church, on the right side, you could go there to this day, on the right side of the stage in Kota, Rajasthan, in India, there's a placard that lists the names of those who have graduated from the Bible school who have actually gone on to become martyrs.
Hmm.
In fact, the next year at the graduation service, these extremists tried to derail the service, and they were throwing Molotov cocktails over, and they were trying to disrupt everything. And Bishop Thomas says, in front of all the graduates, he says, "Tomorrow there will be a service on this property. It will be a funeral service, or it will be a graduation service, but there will be a service."
Wow.
And you just see his faith. Like, he loves Jesus, this guy. And I had never seen anything like that before.
So give us an overview of what's happening to Christians around the world. I think we know there's persecution, but we don't really think about it. What's happening during this conversation as the people listen?
You know, as we're talking now, like, we're seeing first century persecution in the 21st century, and yet on a scale that is incomprehensible. There were more martyrs in the last century than in all the previous centuries combined. You know, in China, in the last year, the Chinese government has shut down the four largest churches in the country. You know, the Christian population in Iraq in the last decade has declined from 1.5 million people to a few hundred thousand people. In Syria, 1.1 million to 400,000 people. I mean, we are seeing an attempt to literally remove Christianity from portions of our planet. And Christians, according to Pew Research, are the most persecuted group in the world, in 108 countries.
Why? Do you think it's a sign of the end of times, or what? Why is the sudden?
You know, Jesus told us, like, this is like part of it.
Right.
You know, we have always been persecuted people. In fact, there's this sort of strange verse, you know, in I think it's John 16, maybe around verse 25 or something, where it says, I'm telling you this because a time will come, and I want you to know this is coming, when people will kill you thinking they're doing a service to God. You know, and some of these terrorists, you know, the ISIS terrorist, who I should say, by the way, killed more Muslims than anyone else. You know, they what made ISIS unique is ISIS decided that Muslims could be heretics as well, and so they actually were excommunicated from Al-Qaeda, oddly enough. They were so awful. They were excommunicated from the worst terrorist group anyone could have imagined. But when ISIS went after Christians, they decided that this was going to be the end. you know, and they were going to take everybody out one by one. And they burned churches and they enslaved women and children. And yet they inadvertently sparked this unbelievable movement towards Christianity all across the Middle East, because all these Christians were willing to die for a faith we're barely willing to live for.
Yeah. Yeah. Talk to me about that. The idea that we have such a weak faith generally, and we, you know, we think we face persecution when, you know, the other day I was about to post something on Facebook and I was like, oh, I shouldn't post that because my friends in the LGBTQ community are going to unfriend me. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm just suffering so much. And you read stories like, you know, I want to hear you talk about Rose of Nigeria and her incredible story. And that is real persecution. Tell us what persecution really is.
Well, here's the thing. Like, I have this conviction. You cannot live a Christian life unless you're either being persecuted yourself or you're close to those who are. This is part of it. And there are lessons you can't learn otherwise. And there's inspiration you can't find. And there's discipleship that cannot be had unless you're close to the persecuted church. That's why every few pages, you know, in scripture, you find this. And all around the world, you find these stories. Like Rose, you know, I was listening to her testimony this morning. I literally played it again so I could remember her words. And Rose is in Nigeria, in the northeast corner of Nigeria, the three states where over 7,000 churches have been destroyed in the last several years. Boko Haram, the terrorist group there, killed more Christians than ISIS in 2015 in this area. And one day the Boko Haram terrorists came to her Christian village. Her husband says he hears the gunfire, says that that doesn't sound like the police. It's a terrorist. He goes and he grabs his own gun. He was a police officer. They invade the house. He shoots every round he has. He kills no one. And then they behead him in front of her eyes. And then they behead her two sons in front of her eyes. And then she runs out of the house to flee. She's 6 months pregnant. She's running as fast as she can. And the terrorists are chasing after her. And they're demanding that she convert. And they're saying to her, say Allah Akbar to convert. And Rose told us, she said, every time they yelled Allah Akbar at me, I turned around over my shoulder and I yelled Jesus back at them. Oh. Allah Akbar, Jesus, Allah Akbar, Jesus. And they sliced at her as they ran and they chased her. And they thought they'd killed her. And yet they hadn't. She laid there on the ground for 2 days, nearly bleeding to death before some medical workers found her. But when we sat with her, you know, she didn't resent her faith or resent Jesus. She didn't resent all of these things. She recognized that we live in an evil world where evil people do evil things. And yet, you know, it was only Jesus that could have helped her survive, having lost everyone that she loved, including the baby that was in her womb because of those terrorists.
I mean, you even question if we serve the same Jesus as Rose, if we're, you know, if we're content to let our faith just be a part of our life instead of everything and worth laying down our life for. Talk to me about that. What are some signs that our faith is too small?
You know, the thing is, like, I love the United States, by the way, and I love the Western world and affluent Christian world that we live in. But God did not give us these blessings for ourselves. Like, the first rule of our American culture is often self-preservation. You know, you do whatever you can to look out for yourself and those you love. And yet the first rule, the kingdom of God, is self-sacrifice. Like, this, our responsibility is to take what God has given us and to pour it out for the good of others. I mean, this is what it is. And I'm telling you, I got to be honest. Like, I am not sure I would still even be a Christian had I not encountered these persecuted believers around the world, because I just had a form of Christianity, had a cultural Christianity, but I didn't see the power of it until I sat with someone who had lost everything, and yet they still loved Jesus. They still had the supernatural power of God himself, you know, in their lives. And I think, you know, as a member of the millennial generation, you know, I think we're a generation that, we're the most diverse generation in human history. We're the most technologically connected. We are humanitarian by our nature. We are optimistic and idealistic. We are a generation custom made to reach to the ends of the earth. But unfortunately, in our Christianity, we have often missed a huge part of Christian history, which is the faith of those who, following Jesus, means not just life, but might mean more to them. And I think the way of awakening the millennial generation isn't like, you know, our great worship music and in our cool churches. It's like going on the front lines and sitting to people who can say, I serve Jesus, not because he gave me anything except for eternal life. And I'm telling you, that's all I needed.
Hmm. I really appreciate you saying positive things about millennials because, you know, we have a bad reputation, I think. But I think our bad reputation comes from a true place, is that we're known for being anxious and we're known for being addicted to approval. And I think that's why I really loved the story of Aaliyah from Kenya, because, I mean, so when I was in college, I almost dated a non-Christian guy, which is not the worst thing possible you could ever do, but it very much was making me derail in my faith because I was like, you know, he's nicer than any guy I've ever known. This guy is, and it just felt like a very big deal to me. And looking back, I realized what I really wanted was approval. And I almost gave up my relationship with Jesus. I don't think I ever would have denounced it, but I would have lost the closest I have now because of that approval. Aaliyah gave up approval of her parents, of all the men, you know, she turned down all the marriage proposals. She was actually, wasn't she disowned by her family because of
eventually
her Christianity?
She was disowned because she
converted.
Tell
me, tell us her story. And I just think that where she got rid of her self-preservation mindset and let go of everyone's approval to follow Jesus.
You know, the beautiful story about Aaliyah is, you know, she immigrated from Kenya to the United States. I would say in an extremist Muslim family, you know, not every Muslim is an extremist. I work with Muslims around the world to help persecuted Christians, but her family was an extremist family. And, eventually, you know, she eventually relents to her family. She marries a man who converts to Islam in order to be married. And then he himself becomes an extremist, and not just an extremist. He becomes a member of Al-Qaeda, at least a sympathizer with Al-Qaeda. You know, and yet in the middle, this all happens in the United States. I mean, this isn't happening somewhere else, you know, on the planet. And yet Aaliyah had really awesome Christian neighbors, and those Christian neighbors invited her to their house for a meal. And then they invited her to their church for a Bible study. And eventually Aaliyah and her children, I mean, they all convert to Christianity, and they lost everything in the United States of America, not in some other place in some other country in the world. They literally lost all that they had. And yet, you know, Aaliyah demonstrates to us, like, as those of us that sometimes face criticism for our faith or isolation or all of these things, like, you know, Jesus was to her absolutely worth losing everything. And by the way, Aaliyah was like one of the least likely people to come to faith in Jesus Christ, but because her neighbors just loved her. And this is something that's in our power. And this is one of the things I love about the millennial generation. We don't have a litmus test for friendship. You know, and I don't think Jesus has a litmus test for friendship. And I think one of the things that we can do as Christians is like we can just invite our neighbors, whatever their religion or their ethnicity, to come to be a part of our community and to experience our faith in an authentic way. And that's what happened in the story of Aaliyah. And when we sat down and talked to her, I mean, she's still struggling. She's still trying to figure out how to live her life, you know, in these two different cultures with a family she loves and a Jesus that she believes is the way and the truth and the life and a church that has become her replacement family. But she's not struggling alone. She's struggling within the context of her Christian community. And that's also part of the Martyr's Oath. You know, this is not a book that attempts to sanitize these stories and make it all look like, you know, following Jesus means a path to peace and prosperity. Sometimes following Jesus means a path to a lot of loss. But the one thing that we don't ever lose, and that people listening to us, that, you know, I mean, we can say to them, like, the one thing you will never lose is the fact that your God is a friend that sticks closer than a brother, that he says, you can cast all your cares upon me today. Because not just because I'll take your cares, but because I care for you. I really care for you. And I've seen this in every corner of the planet. People who could have kept everything if they just would have denied Jesus, and they chose not to deny him, and they don't regret the decision.
Yeah, yeah. It brings to mind the question for me, the average young adult listening to this, you know, they're driving in their car, they're cleaning their room, and they're like, wow, I want to get on the front lines. I want my faith to be like that. But, you know, they can't afford a trip to India to see this happening firsthand. They don't read about these on the news because they, you know, they don't get reported on a lot. Aside from just reading about these people, what can we do to test our faith more?
You know, this is the benefit of being the millennial generation. You know, I think our parents and their grandparents are sort of envy of us, actually. That's why they criticize us.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
They really wish they were us. You know, but in the digital age, all these barriers are gone. You know, and by the way, you know, you can save up money and buy a cheap plane ticket and go somewhere. But the truth is you don't have to. You know, these days, the digital world allows us to connect with people. You know, you can, you know, one time when I was at Liberty University, we picked, I'm not going to say the country, but we picked the most difficult country on the planet to get the message of Jesus to. And what we did is we raised money and we spent thousands of dollars using digital advertising to target people who were searching for hope and who were asking certain questions on the internet. We bypassed the governments and the barriers and the walls and went straight to the hearts of the people through their computers and through their iPhones. I mean, this is the stuff you can do in the world that we're living in.
Wow.
I mean, you know, there's some people that I communicate with on Twitter through direct messages. You would just be so surprised. They run countries and they live in totally, totally different cultures. But the conversations we're able to have in the digital age. And so I think as millennials, I mean, I think sometimes we talk a good game, you know, and our heart is there, you know, for sure. But we need to kind of put some action to it. But that action doesn't have to involve wandering around a country somewhere in the digital age. You know, it's all right here. And then, by the way, in a diverse world we're living in, you know, there isn't a language or a religion or an ethnicity almost on the planet that doesn't exist around the corner. You just have to decide to engage.
Yeah, we literally have no excuse, right? Except, I think, distraction. I think that's our biggest thing as millennials. We just get distracted.
Well, of course. I mean, this is what's going to happen. You're going to pick up, you know, Twitter and you're going to try to find somebody at some place and you care. And then all of a sudden you get distracted or Instagram or something else. You know, but right. These are tools that God gave us. And they're, you know, God wants us to use them for good in the world that we're living in.
Yeah.
And we have every opportunity to know everyone that we want to know and everything that we need to know. And in so doing, I mean, I've said this a lot, like I went to these countries to try to help people. But in the end, I'm the one that was changed.
Right, right. I want to ask one more question as we wrap up. As you were talking to these people that have incredible stories, and your book has so many that we couldn't cover, as you were talking to them, were there any commonalities you noticed in before their story of persecution happened? The ones that were Christians and then got persecuted for it, what were they doing in the peaceful times? What were they doing in their day-to-day lives that prepared them for that moment?
You know, everyone just read the Bible. I mean, there's so many people in this storybook, which is really what the Martyr's Oath is. They just encountered scriptures and they read it, and they read it regularly. And that's often what got them in the trouble they were in. But it's often what sustained them. You know, there's one Chinese pastor in the book. His name's Peter. And Peter's grandmother became a Christian because of someone that Watchman Nee, the famous missionary, trained. Watchman Nee trained this person. He led Peter's grandma to Christ, who was in all kinds of witchcraft and everything. Peter ends up in prison because he becomes a Bible teacher. And the jailer gets curious about Christianity, and he has by law to provide educational time for these people. So he lets Peter teach the Bible just as a cultural thing. You know, Peter didn't have a Bible, but he had so much of the Bible in his mind and his heart. He taught it and taught it and taught it. Eventually, the jailer becomes a Christian. I mean, it's like a story out of the book of Acts. But these are all people that love the Word of God. And this is our risk, by the way, because we can let our heart lead us into a kind of spirituality that isn't anchored in truth. We can let our worship songs with their powerful, beautiful scriptural lyrics, you know, replace the actual text. And one of the things I've stopped doing, actually, is I've stopped reading so much on my phone. I've gone back to like good old fashioned books, in part, you know, because I have young kids and I want them to see me read. And secondly, I just read differently. And then when I'm on my digital devices, you know, rather than reading like on my Kindle, I listen, because listening somehow helps me, by the way I'm designed, to retain more of the stories. But everybody in this book that persevered when it was all said and done are people who had anchors on scripture. And by the way, they weren't theologians, and most of them weren't pastors like we're used to it. They were just like regular everyday Christians who took the Bible seriously. And that was enough to get through, literally, for some of them, hell on earth.
Wow. I think that's so convicting, but also inspiring that we have all that we need, you know, like we talked about in 1 Peter, that we have what we need for this life. Like, we can be just like those people. They're not different than us. They're not more equipped. God didn't, you know, say they're better than that millennial sitting on Twitter or whatever. We're just like them, and we can be just like them. And that's so encouraging.
Yeah. And, you know, we focus so much on God's will, like in this age and stage of life. And, I spent the first 12 years of my professional life as the campus pastor at Liberty University.
And so, you know,
I know, like, every it was a rotating door. What is God's will for my life?
Yes.
Eventually, I wrote a whole book called What Am I Supposed to Do with My Life? And I did it because I was tired of answering the question. You know, but one of the points I make and I made with those students, and I think it's good for us, like, you know, this is what the Bible says about God's will. It says nothing about vocation or location. It says this is God's will, that you be sanctified. Right. God's will is about who you are. It's not where you are or what you're doing. It's about you, because you take you with you everywhere you go. You know, and that was also the story of so many of these people I met around the world. And the stories I've retold in the Martyr's Oath, they were just like people who loved God. They were discipled, sanctified Christians, and they took them with them, whether they were in freedom or in prison. And that's why many of them were able to change the lives of a lot of people. They didn't try so hard to be a witness. They just were by their lives.
Wow. It's so simple, and I think we miss it so often. So thank you so much. Thank you for your research and your passion for this, to teach us this perspective, I think, on Christianity.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the book that Johnny Moore wrote is called The Martyr's Oath, and we want to make that book available to you for a gift of any amount to Boundless. If you go to boundless.org, click on the book there, you can select any kind of donation that you want to give to this ministry that you love, and we will send this book as our thank you to you. Again, the book is The Martyr's Oath. Go to boundless.org and check it out. Oh, it's just you and me. It's only you and me. Well, as we finish out the show, we open up our inbox, and I get to answer this week's question, so I'm excited about that. Our listener says, a young man and I have been betrothed since birth. Although our fathers, who've known each other since college, did this jokingly, this boy and I have felt teased by our fathers and close friends about it since we were little. Between the time I graduated from college and began graduate school, I was this boy's coworker. We both worked for his father. During that time, I became completely smitten. I've gotten the sense that he reciprocates, but lately I haven't been so sure. I'm aware that he's still badgered by friends and family to court me. I can only imagine that this makes the whole situation extremely awkward for him. I'm wondering, how can I be proactive in a way that he is aware of my affection, but that is not pushy? All right. Well, good question. And I'm glad you kind of, you know, the fact that this is kind of like a joking betrothal, but still they're kind of assuming like, oh, these two are going to get together. So that makes some awkward assumptions come into play. And I'm sure, you know, you're feeling like, yeah, this is kind of weird. I really have two options for you. And I feel like I'm a few years older than you, I'm sure. And so I feel like maybe some of this is speaking out of this, becoming more pragmatic in this sense. But let me give you my two options. The first one is, you do nothing. You let this play out. Again, you know, you see what he thinks of you. I mean, maybe this is just a time and space thing. Clearly, he knows that you exist. So you do nothing because you want to give him the opportunity to step forward, take leadership, which is always a good thing. Take the risk, always a good thing on the guy's part. But in order to do this, you're going to have to not give up too much in the process. So the whole, you know, all this angsty, like, how can I let him know that I like him and should I flirt with him and stuff is going to be a little crazy making for you. So I would say, basically, you know, you need to give him space. You need to let him come after you. You go about your business. You do what you're doing. Like I said, he knows that you exist. He knows where to find you. And you just have to trust that if this is meant to be, then it's going to happen. And so meanwhile, that may mean dating other guys. It may mean being open to other relationships. It may mean just getting into other stuff other than worrying about like, oh, is this thing going to play out like I always thought it would? And now as I hope it will. And so that is one of your options. The other option is probably going to come as a surprise to some people, because I'm going to say, you know, you could choose to address the awkwardness of this head on. And that is, you know, you clearly have a context of history with this guy. And this is probably the only reason I would suggest this, in that you could probably say in a playful kind of humorous way, you know, hey, I know that we're, you know, set up, or we've been set up practically since birth, and, you know, we're supposed to be betrothed and all this stuff. You know, the fact is, I actually think you're kind of a catch and a great guy, and I just want you to know that. And you put it out there. Now, if this guy cannot run with that, he is either not interested in you or he doesn't deserve you. Okay, that is enough of a statement for you to just say, look, I know that this feels awkward. I know this looks awkward. I know everyone is assuming and or hoping that we're going to get together. You know, there is no guarantee that that's going to happen. But just so you know, I'm open to it. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that, especially since this guy kind of has played out a little bit of a brotherly relationship with you, given the connection between your families. So really, you just have to decide if you're okay with one of those solutions, because otherwise, I think you're in a spot where you're feeling very agitated over the what ifs around this. And so, you know, truth be told, it's weird that there are all these assumptions by people. It's not like, you know, they kind of have their designs on you for how this relationship is going to go. But ultimately, it's your decision and this guy's decision. So just either address it head on and be like, look, I just want you to know, you're probably assuming that this is all because, you know, people think this has to happen. But if you're, you know, depending on how you feel, I could be in. If you could, just see where this goes. Otherwise, you need to go ahead and play it straight and just be like, you know what? I'm leaving this in God's hands. I'm going to just separate myself a little bit, not obsess over it, not worry about it. And if he's interested, he knows where to find me. So that would be my advice for you. And I hope you maybe try one of the two of those, or maybe you try both at some point and let us know how it works out, because we'd love to get an update on this one. So, all right, folks. Well, that is it for this week's show. As always, we do want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org with whatever you would like to comment on about the show, whether this question or something else, or just tell us what God's been doing in your life. We would love to hear from you. Otherwise, I will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.